The Term Machine Radio. Hello and welcome to episode 5 of Hot Dub Time Machine Radio. My name's Tom, aka Hot Dub. Welcome, it's lovely to have you here again. Now, I know I said last week I'd have my interview with Julian from the presets for you, but I ran out of time with all the whining and the machining, and I'm trying to make all these episodes super slick and professional for you, and that one is not quite done yet. So that will come out next week, I promise. However, that means that this week you get my favorite interview ever. It's with a guy I consider a massive idol, a bit of a DJ kind of god to me anyway, and basically a massive man crush, El Gusto from Hermitude. El Gusto, also known as Angus Stewart, started Hermitude with his friend Dubs, also known as Luke, around the year 2000s, and for years they were loved and admired as makers of lush instrumental hip-hop. They released 3 albums in the 2000s, Alleys to Valleys, Tales of the Drift, and Threads, which are really gorgeous and deserve a lot more love as they're like stunning, mellow, and quite experimental music. I recommend you check them out. Then, after almost breaking up, they came back with a huge bang in the 2010s with their album Hyper Paradise, which exploded them onto a wider audience in Australia. And then, when an unknown teenage producer from the northern beaches of Sydney called Flume remixed the title track, the world finally heard what Hermitude could do. But even then, they were just warming up, and in 2015, their 5th album, Dark Night Sweet Light, and especially song The Buzz, broke through everywhere all across the world, and they finally arrived in their rightful position at the very top of the music industry. Angus is a really lovely and deeply talented guy, and we share an almost cult-like love of DJ Shadow, so I was super excited and quite honoured to sit down with him in his house in the inner west of Sydney to talk about his amazing musical life.
Here with El Gusto from Hermitude, aka Angus.
Yo.
Thanks for doing this, man. We're here in your inner west abode.
Yep, that's right, in the lounge room.
It's very nice. Planes might come over at any moment, but that's how we do here in the inner west.
Yeah, that's where we get the funk from.
Yeah. So, Manny, I wanted to talk to you about your life and music and things like that. So we'll start right back at the beginning. Your dad is a musician?
Yep, that's correct.
What kind of music does he play?
He came up playing guitar and he played a lot of jazz and then sort of, you know, blues and funk and stuff like that.
And does he make a living from it?
Yeah. He made a lot of his bread from, he ended up like composing music for film and TV.
Okay.
And stuff like that. Yeah.
Any film and TV that were not?
He did a lot of work for some of like Hanna-Barbera cartoons and stuff like that. Yeah. And, he was in studios a lot, and that's I remember going in as a little kid, you know, and walking into some famous Sydney studios, and he'd be in there and,
cool,
you know, with a small orchestra conducting
Fire.
And stuff like that. Yeah.
Wow. So, yeah. And is your mum musical at all?
No, my mum's not musical. She was she went to art school. She did visual arts, and then she sort of raised us.
And so what kind of music do you remember hearing around the house when you were little? Do you remember any kind of stuff that they would play?
I know. I remember on Saturdays I would always wake up to some sort of music blasting. A lot of times it was like some blues or something just like cranked up. It was a bit of a range. We didn't much have any kind of like of the classic rock stuff, I would say. That never really was in my life. So a lot of like when we're at the pub and classic rock songs come on and everyone starts singing, I'm always kind of like, I feel, I don't know this one.
So it wasn't like a pop music.
No. But it was like, I mean, like Steely Dan and, you know.
What's good Steely Dan? I don't even know much about Steely.
Well, funnily enough, my sister is named after one of their records, Asia. There was lots of stuff I remember listening to. I mean, Michael Jackson was a big one. Thriller and Bad. You know, I was just tripping out on that. And then Prince, Sign of the Times was another big record that got a lot of play. Oh, yeah. Um, me and my sister had a cassette tape of it. Like, we
how many sisters do you have?
Or
you...
I just have one sister.
Just one, okay.
Yeah, we, you know, like, we dubbed the record onto cassette tape, and we both had a Walkman or whatever, and we used to fight over this tape.
Of a Prince.
Yeah,
sweet. Died of a big disease with a little name. By chance his girlfriend came. And so when did you start learning music? When did you start doing lessons and stuff? Because I think you're a trained drummer and stuff. Is that the first instrument you did?
I mean, I got some like guitar lessons when I was, you know, in primary school. And
did you ever do piano?
Never did piano.
Okay.
Which I wish I did. I really wish I, you know, learnt piano, because I feel like that's a really good basis of just musical theory.
But then you wouldn't need dubs, though.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's the way me and dubs come together, like Voltron, you know? Like,
yeah.
The legend of Voltron, defender of the universe.
But my uncle, who is Hamish Stewart, is a really amazing drummer around Sydney and Australia. Well, yeah, I remember kind of going, oh, maybe, you know, oh, maybe I want to try drums because I really like what Hamish does, you know. And so I went and tried drums, and then it just clicked.
You know? How old were you when you did come?
I probably would have been about 9 or 10, and then like by 11, Dad started, you know, a bass drum turned up, and then like a snare drum. And then, you know, I could play bass drum and snare drum, and then like...
Oh, what did he told you, like, was you just like finding them kind of...
Yeah, it was just this random like junk kit, basically.
Sweet. And then, did you do lessons and stuff?
Yeah, I did some lessons. I went down to Billy Hyde's in Sydney to do lessons.
Billy Hyde's is the kind of mecca for drummers in Sydney especially. It was this massive, beautiful drum stock shop.
Yeah, it was like, you know, like some sort of paradise or wonderland when I was going in there as a kid. There was, you know, cymbals and drums everywhere. And
it's so huge. It was full of stuff.
Man. It was crazy.
Are there any like drummers that rocked your world?
Yeah, I'll tell you a story is where I got my kind of drumming influence from. Is one time I had a friend over, you know, I was like probably 12, 13.
Sleepovers, excited.
Yeah. And we, you know, were running down the hallway and we're running past my dad's sort of office, I suppose, you know, music office room. He's like, Angus, James, come in here for a second. And we're like, what? You know, we're just running out to, you know, whatever. And he's like, no, come here. And he's like, sit down and listen to this. And he put on Herbie Hancock's Chameleon. And, you know, the bass line comes in. Bow, 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 bow.
Bum, 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 bum.
And then the drums come in and he's like, listen to the drummer. And I was like, listening to it. It was just the way he just held his groove, you know. It's just so funky. And like that record and that sort of moment really... For me, it was like a solidifying moment of groove.
You're like, I want to do that.
I want to do that. I want to make people feel like that's making me feel, you know? Like,
yeah.
And so that was a really big moment. And that's hip-hop to me as well, like that feel, you know? It's just like crazy groove.
So then you continue to do drums and through stuff through high school, and you kind of met dubs and jazz bands and things,
yeah,
is that correct?
We met in the school jazz band, which... My dad was helping run.
Dubs, what was he playing in the jazz band? Was he on the
keys? He was playing piano. And he's like 4.5 years older than me. And basically what had happened is the drummer, like it was like a school, you know, school band basically. But it was like the Blue Mountains Conservatorium basically, which was attached to the school I went to. So there was actually, it wasn't just school kids, it was just like musicians from all around. So there was people there from who were old, like older people who were coming in playing horns and stuff like that. So it went from basically from me, who was about 11, to people who were like 50 something.
Right on.
Yeah.
And at 11, were you getting to go on the kit? You weren't having to like stand there on the triangle and stuff?
No, well, this is the thing. Like, this is where my dad, he basically, you know, their drummer was some other kid, and he kind of didn't want to do it anymore, left.
Right.
And he said to me, he's like, Angus, can you please just come and fill in while we find another drummer? And I was like, oh, I don't know, you know, I'm like still learning, you know. I could only play like 4-5 beats, you know. And he was like, you know, it's a swing beat, so, you know, you remember the swing beat I told you, you know, ding, 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 ding. It's like, that's all you have to do.
Do you remember any songs that you played in that band that you liked?
Yeah, like Cold Duck Time, So What? Anyway, so, and he basically conned me into coming and playing, and then he never found another drummer, basically. And it was just like, this will be good for him, you know, he'll learn lots. And, which it was, and I, you know, I learned. But that's where I met Luke, and he was 14, 15 or something.
Yep. And what did you guys... become friends straight away? I mean, well, that kind of age difference is big.
Yeah, exactly. I was just like, oh, that's Luke, the piano player. He's cool. Like, I remember him coming in wearing like a Primus t-shirt.
Did you know what Primus was?
I didn't really know what Primus was.
And so then kind of turned you on to those
guys. Yeah, and my friend gave me a tape of them because I was talking about this Primus t-shirt, and then I fell in love with, you know,
Les Claypool. What was your favourite Primus song? Of course, for me, it's Tommy the Cat.
Tommy the Cat is like,
I remember as though it was a meal ago.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Tommy the Cat is a real back clear out of a form out of maimedness, little twain to his mighty throat. Many a fat other rat met his demise while starting point blank on the cover of Spiral, this awesome prowling machine.
Anyway, so we didn't really hang out, me and Dubs, until maybe I got to about 12, or maybe about 13.
A couple of years later.
Yeah, and I asked him to come and jam outside of the band because I was getting like playing into like funk music and stuff like that. With my sister, who's a bass player.
Oh, right on. So at home, you were just like kind of...
So at home, we had this, it was like a little room and it was the library and it was like literally covered wall to wall with books. And we had our bass amp and drum kit in there and we would just come home after school and jam.
Did your sister make a career out of music as well?
We played in bands together up until I was about 25 and she would have been about 26, 27. She had
a proper job.
Yeah, well, she didn't really, you know, like loading into the backs of pubs at like, or at loading out at like 1 a.m. wasn't really her vibe, you know. But she loved music. She loves music and she was a really great bass player.
It's interesting. I mean, there's such a musical upbringing. And so you got the jam house and then Dubs come over for a jam. Like you just kind of, you want to play some funk with him and stuff.
Yeah. So we're like just jamming and literally just lots of improvisation. And we would just jam for hours. You know, that's where we all really connected. Like I connected with Luke and Asia, my sister, we all just connected and it was really, really fun. And we started playing as a band, a little band around the mountains.
Did that turn into the I forgot the name of the first it's, band.
It's a terrible name.
It was Funk
Injection.
Funk Injection.
It's just like, you know, that was the
Did
name.
Did you guys put out any music in a Funk Injection?
We recorded like a couple of EPs, I think.
Okay.
But we never really properly released them because we were just kids.
So when did you discover hip-hop?
Hip-hop came into my life probably a little bit after Primus. So around maybe 14.
And so that would have been like kind of mid-90s?
Mid-90s, yeah.
Do you remember any like songs?
You know, Warren G, Regulators and like...
California Love, I suppose.
All that stuff was kind of... It was kind of around in my ether, but it wasn't until like Dubs actually gave me a mixtape of... a bunch of stuff, and it had Tribe Called Quest, it had The Roots.
Do you remember which songs?
Oh man, Illadelph Half Life.
That's the name of the album?
Yeah.
Well, do you remember Tribe Called Quest? Was it like, can I kick it? Or?
Yeah, it was Electric Relaxation.
With your black hair and your fat ass style, street poetry is my everyday.
It was like a sick tape.
It was just a sick tape, and it was like had all this great. I guess it was kind of like jazz influenced hip hop, you know, and things like Diggable Planets, like cool like that.
So it's kind of the jazzier.
Yeah, it was kind of like the jazzier stuff, and that really related to me coming from playing jazz and funk growing up. It was like, wow, these dudes are doing this, and they're taking loops and like putting just like a mad like groove over the top.
And so was that where you, like you're starting to get interested in the production of the music?
Yeah, I was like, how do they do that?
Yeah. You know?
And I literally asked my dad, I was like, how do they do that? And he was like, I think it's they're using samplers.
Was your dad, was he a purist at all about like...
You know, I think he appreciated the sort of culture of hip hop, but he sort of, you know, like when it was like an obvious, you know, rip of like, you know, a Coltrane song or something like that, he'd be like, oh, that's, you know, they're just taking that. And at that time, just before I got into hip hop, I didn't like electronic music at all. I hated it.
Well, you're a drummer.
I was a drummer and I listened to like James Brown on repeat. I just was like into real playing and real music, like real music.
Musicians. But drum machines putting drummers out of jobs.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but then hip hop was the what, you know, moved me over into like appreciating that style of music, because it was like harking back to these, you know, real players and using that and their groove,
okay,
and then putting something really new and cool over the top.
Well, so then, like, you finished school. Did you, were you ever not going to be a musician? Was there ever a time where you thought, like, I'm going to go and study and become a pilot or anything?
Not at all. I decided, but before I finished school, I was like 16, 17. I was just like, I can't wait to finish school so I can get out there and just play gigs and like make records and be a musician.
Cause just be, and be a drummer?
Well, no, by that stage, I had, at 15, my dad really got into Afro-Cuban percussion all of a sudden. I don't know how it happened, but he just was like right into it. And
what does Afro-Cuban percussion?
Like congas and, you know, timbales. I actually started learning those, that as a drummer. My dad was got right into it and he was like, I'm taking a trip to Cuba. Would you like to come?
Whoa.
And I was like, hell yeah, I would. It was kind of like a weird time because my parents split.
How old are you?
I was 15.
And you went to Cuba for a month.
I went to Cuba for a month and we literally stayed in Havana and studied Afro-Cuban percussion.
Wow.
Yeah, so basically we would go up, we'd walk up this street every day and go to this guy's house, Roberto Viscano. Mm-hmm. And he was a conga player, percussionist, and he played for a famous Cuban piano player called Chuchu Valdez.
A good name. Yeah. Chuchu Valdez, yeah, man.
And we literally found this guy at his friend's house when we were looking for a place to rent. And he was like, oh, you want to learn percussion? And because we were just talking and stuff. And he was like, oh, I'm a percussionist. Like, come and, you know, I play for these people. And we were like, oh, you play for Chuchu Valdez? And he was like, yeah, come and I'll teach you. And we were like, great. So we did that for a month. At the same time,
wow,
there was like literally 7-year-old kids on the corner playing buckets that would just shred me to pieces. So I was kind of like, what am I even doing here? You know, yeah, this is crazy. Like it was just in them. You know?
I mean, it's a very intense place, yeah, just like even music aside.
Yeah.
And so you kind of, we really turned you on to percussion more. Is that what you...
Well, at the same time, I was really getting into hip hop at that point.
Okay.
So I was, but you know, my dad's like, do you want to come to Cuba? And I was like, hell yeah. You know, I'm still playing drums and like love it, you know? So I went and did that. But every day afterwards, I would go home, you know, at night where we were staying, and I would put on my headphones and I'd be listening to hip hop.
What kind of hip hop?
I started listening to a bit of like more of the UK stuff, like from the Ninja Tune label, like Herbalizer.
So you started getting into the beats.
Yeah, the beats and the production and the scratching.
Right.
And it's like, you know, one time for your mind. Rip, 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 rip. You know, it was just like really tastefully like added to the music. And I was like, man, scratching, what the... And so basically I saved up money and so I got like some Gemini turntables and a Gemini mixer.
So these are like techniques. These are the training wheels. Yes. So you're like 16, 15, 16?
Yeah. And I was just like, you know, I didn't really know how they did it, but I just wanted to do it real bad.
Right.
So then I started, you know, because I was scratching on the record, but then I bought a VHS of like the Invisible Scratch Pickles,
who are like the elite scratch DJs of the world. Mixmaster Mike from the Beastie Boys, Q-Bert.
Yeah.
D-Styles,
man. Yeah, he's my favorite. So I got into scratching, and then at some point, me and my friend, a good friend of mine, saved up and went halves in an Akai S2000 sampler. And that's where the production started. And I would have been about 16 and a half.
So you'd sit there, I'm just imagining you kind of learning. So you said that you got the video of the scratch pickles. You're watching their incredibly complex routines and stuff.
Yeah.
And you're just trying to copy and learn from that?
Yep, I was just trying to like, okay, they're using the crossfader.
The hard thing about that is getting the records to do it with, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like just thinking, where does that fresh sound come from? How
totally
do I find that?
Well, that was, you know, Central Station Records.
Okay, so you go down into Sydney and do some shopping.
You know, the DJ Rectangle battle records,
yes,
and stuff
absolutely
like that. I would get, you know, one of those, just one, because $20 was like, you know, that's all I would have a week maybe.
Were you just practicing heaps?
Yeah, I mean, and music was my life, you know. I just basically would get home from school and I would either play drums or I would scratch.
That's all you did, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like learning how to scratch. Kind of, I was excited to ask you this as well, because it's such a repetitive process, just training your hands to do the shit that your hands can do.
Dude, I had like drum rudiments then transferred to like turntables. So I would do like, you know, drum rudiments might be like right, right, left, left, right, right, left, left. I'd be doing, you know, like forward, forward, back, back, forward, forward, back, back on the turntable and stuff like that. Just like, I mean, turntables is an instrument, you know, it was just another instrument.
So what year did you finish school?
2000.
And so then you got like 3 years to Allies to Valleys.
That's right. So towards the end of high school, I had bought the sampler and I was learning how to sample. You know, I was basically going through my dad's record collection.
Right, so you're starting to make beats.
Yeah, starting to make beats. It took
so that's like an incredibly elaborate process on, this is, I don't know, it's just a hardware thing that you kind of plug.
Yeah, it's literally, it was like a box with a tiny screen and a few dials on the front, and it had like a minute and a half of sample time or something, and you would like sample a record and then you would like use this dial to like, you know, select the start point of the sample and then the end point, and then you could trigger it with a like a MIDI keyboard or something. Sweet. And then sequence it on a computer like a, yeah, it was like a really old school process. And back then it's like YouTube didn't exist, so I couldn't just be like, how do you do this?
How to make 50 ways to make a hip hop beat.
Yeah, it was like I would read the manual. You know, my dad was like, oh, you know, it's MIDI. And I was like, what the hell is MIDI? And I was like, anyway, so all these things were, it was very, it took me a long time to just figure out the basics of how to like sequence a track.
Was any of the music like really rocking you well?
Yeah, like DJ Shadow.
Yes.
Introducing was my, like, that was the holy Bible of, like, for sampling. And, like, I was like, how did he do that?
So like, that came out in, like, 96. When did it come into your life?
Around probably 97. Or,
yeah, right on.
You know, I was working in a cafe and this, one of my co-workers, this woman was playing it. And I was like, what is this?
Do you remember which song it was?
Quarter Past Midnight.
Yeah, Midnight in a Perfect World. DJ Show is a massive figure in my life as well, so we got around to it. But like, I remember the first time I heard Midnight at Perfect World, a friend played it at like a party, and I just remember the spins, like the spins. Like. Wow, that's so cool. And like all these sounds, he's just cut them all together, and what the fuck? What is this?
It still to this day sounds, it's like an incredible piece of art. Like it's just like, it's like collage, you know, work. Basically, and it, but it sounds, everything fits together beautifully. There was like that, you know, like classical and rock influences through it, like, you know, and it's got the hip hop backbone and everything, but it just had this amazing.
And so you were like, I want to do that.
Yeah.
And he's also like a badass scratcher, like the dude can, he can really cut.
Dude, yeah. It was like everything, you know, like I was like, oh my God, it blew my mind. And that was my, I was like, I want to be like that, you know.
Yeah.
And I started making tracks and I was like getting pretty good. But that's when I asked Luke to come over and play some piano on some of the stuff that I was making with this sampler. And that was the beginnings of Hermitude.
You guys made the first three albums you did together, Allies to Valley, Tales of the Drift, and Threads. Like, it kind of seems unfair. So much work to like just bundle together in one thing like that. But it's tempting to do. How do you feel about those first three albums now?
So awesome. I love those records.
For instance, Allies to Valleys. Like, the thing I find interesting about is Gusto's theme.
Yeah.
Because like from a scratching point of view, it's so fucking good.
Thanks, man. Yeah, it was, I mean, that was like, I guess what, it was 2003 by that stage. So I'd been scratching since I was probably 15, 16.
Yeah. So as you're making these albums, were you still playing drums in other bands and stuff?
Yeah. But my focus had very much kind of shifted to making beats, basically. I, you know, and people were coming up to me going, man, why aren't you playing drums as much? You know, you should, you're a great drummer. You should keep playing drums. And I'll be like, yeah, yeah.
All the old musos in the Blue Mountains.
Yeah, yeah. Like,
what's this kid doing? We got to get him on the right track.
Yeah, I was shifting, you know, and and I still played a lot of drums, still play gigs, but I was like really starting focusing on stuff.
Making beats with dubs. Was
yeah,
fun.
And we were making this shit and we were like, hey, this is actually pretty good. You know, this is, there's something here, you know.
Any favorite songs from those albums that you
Oh, yeah. You I love? Mean, okay, Alice the Valleys. I really love the opening track, Massive Passive.
Yep.
Because it's really, it's like a journey.
For sure.
It has no sort of regular song structure, which is a lot of our music back then, because we weren't like songwriters. We were like musicians who played in bands. And we would play songs, but for some reason when it came to making beats, it would just start here and it would end somewhere else, you know?
Definitely. It's like we listen to like a Herbalizer and they'll come up with a groove and that groove will last the entire song basically. And they might like have a chorus and have a rapper who comes in and stuff, but your stuff can be a bit more like kind of late Beatles shit in that you'll skip through a bunch of stages. And
I don't think we had a great concept of like songwriting back then.
Right.
And in some ways gave us a great freedom and made for interesting music, and in other ways maybe was a bit sort of hard for some listeners, you know.
Yeah.
That we would just go off on tangents, you know.
You're right. They kind of feel like collages.
Yeah, they were totally collages. And that was probably, you know, big DJ Shadow influence and stuff like that. And like dudes like Eamon Tobin who would just be these masters of sound, you
yeah.
know.
I feel like Alice DeValley, man. I listened to it on the plane the other day and like, it's nice. Like, it's a kind of, it's a chilled out experience.
Yeah. I mean, that was the sound back then too, you know, it was like.
The thing I find odd about those albums, like, but then when the MC comes, it kind of comes over the top. It's like, where does that kind of come from?
Yeah. Well, I mean, hip hop, you know, hip-hop. We wanted like rappers, you know, as well. But mostly we were instrumental and mostly like, you know, we grew up playing in an instrumental funk band. It was always just more about instrumental music for us than from rappers. And that's where the UK like trip hop, you know, Ninja Tune kind of thing, Portishead's not instrumental, but that sound was really a big influence, you know, because it had the American hip hop kind of beats and everything, but it was open and it was very musical, you know, you could have other things over the top.
Are there any particular songs that you feel like were influences on that early stage of your career?
Yeah, I mean, Portishead.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, anything from Rhodes and Wandering Star. Please, could you stay away to share my grief? So I saw them in, there was a festival out in Parramatta, like almost 10 years ago now, and they headlined.
That's right. I wasn't here for that. Yeah.
But yeah. I went out and I saw them, and because I never saw them in their heyday, and I was like bummed about it because they were like also everything to me in terms of production. Holy shit! You know, like that shit sounded so good and scratching.
Absolutely.
They could write songs, but I went and saw them, and it was probably one of the best things I've ever seen. And this is like 10 years later. You know.
Yeah.
But I was like almost in tears watching them. How can I feel? From this moment, I cannot feel this
right. After Threads, you guys took a break for a little while. And then 2011, Get In My Life, as you've kind of described, as a song that kind of reawakened you into a new sound.
Yeah, after Threads, we took a break. We kind of, Threads kind of like plateaued for us, you know, like we were sort of, Alice DeValley's was like, we came on the scene, people were into it. Tales of the Drift, it sort of, we took another step up. And Threads, it was like another, you know, step, but it didn't really like go, we didn't go too much further in terms of a career kind of thing. And then after that, we kind of, you know, we did some touring and it was good, but it wasn't like great, you know. And it was kind of a little bit sort of like, are we going to do another record? Don't know.
Mm.
And at that point, you know, like dudes like Flying Lotus and like Hudson Mohawk and all that, that this kind of sound started happening.
Did you like that stuff? Were you listening to it and like?
Yeah. Well, I think that's what happened. By the time we got to Threads as well, it was felt like we were a little bit like, what's the kind of instrumental UK hip hop scene had kind of died off a bit, you know? And Shadow was in the past as well, and there was no clear sort of scene of cool like instrumental beat stuff.
It could be inspired by.
Yeah, and like, and having that those years off was cool because then yeah, like dudes like Philo came along and just kind of blew shit up again.
So let's talk specifically about Get In My Life. Is there reasonable to say that that's like the song that got you back into it?
Yeah, for sure. Like that track, I think I remember having a conversation with Luke, you know, do we want to do this again? Do we want to, you know, do some more Hermitude stuff? And he was like, yeah, you know, like, and I was like, yeah, like, I want to do some more kind of bass driven stuff, you know, and some more like just dance floor stuff. Because before that, it was like you were saying with Alice of Alice, it was kind of nice, you know, it's like a softer listening music kind of thing.
Yeah, yes. Not bangers.
Not bangers, basically.
So Get In My Life is a banger.
Yeah.
Are there any songs that you remember really digging and kind of having an influence on it?
A lot of like early Scream and Lo-Fi and stuff like that.
It was also like the Rusko stuff was kind of quite heavy.
Yeah, that sort of came along and that was kind of like the demise of dubstep in my eyes.
Right.
Like he, I mean that... what's that song? The
Cockney Thug?
No. Cockney Thug.
Wake the fuck up! Fuck!
It's huge and it was great. And I was like, this is fucking amazing. But that was kind of the beginning of the abrasive, you know.
And you went into that?
That was good. And there was a few songs that came along after that was good. And then it just got too abrasive, you know.
Okay.
But that's where the kind of like in Get In My Life, the kind of pulsing LFO bass line kind of thing came from. I don't know. I basically wrote that, the beginnings of Get In My Life, you know, in my bedroom in Marrickville, the beat and the bass line. And I had that and I was like, I took it to Luke and I was like, dude, I think this is the kind of new sound that we should look at, you know. He was like, yeah, man, that's killer. Because the drums are kind of swung. They had that kind of swing, the sort of hip-hop Dilla kind of swing that, like, Philo had started coming out again with, like...
And so, like, how long did it take you to make?
Well, then...
So you knocked up it. It had an original groove to the dubs.
Yeah, I took it to the dubs, and then we put in the chorus, basically the melody. I was like, we need to, like, you know, make it bang in the chorus, and we need, like, basically... But we want it to be instrumental. Like, yeah. We need a sick melody. So we sat in my bedroom and we sort of came up with the melody. And that was it. And we were like, sick, this is dope.
And then what happened when you played it to a crowd?
Well, it was cool, actually. We had a gig at Woodford Folk Festival and that was the first time we played it live. And it made us realise that we were onto something, basically.
There's a video on YouTube like that. Have you seen it? It's like from behind the stage, like looking past you guys.
Yeah.
Like people were just... That was losing their minds.
That was it. That was like...
Was that different to the reaction that you used to get?
I mean, now it's kind of... That sort of reaction happens a lot, you know?
Yeah.
Because, but previous to that, we're off the back of Threads, which was more chill. We weren't like a big festival band or anything, you know? And so this was the first big kind of like...
Because you're like rocking a party now.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that song, like, it was like, hey, we're going to play a new track. And this is... pre-Hyper Paradise album, you know, and we dropped it and it was just like boom, exploded, and it was like, wow, okay, we're on to something, like let's do this, you know.
Sick, man. Yeah. Well, let's talk about Speak of the Devil a little bit, because that was maybe your first kind of mainstream hit, would you say?
Indeed.
Yeah, It feels a bit like an old Hermitage track, and I can hear some things that sound like samples. But there's also, it's just happy,
yeah,
and like funky,
yeah,
and really fun.
Yeah.
What are your influences on that track? What do you feel about that?
It was so funny when we wrote that track, because we were writing the album Hyper Paradise, and a lot of it was kind of more, I don't know, it was less up-tempo than that. I remember we wrote Speak of the Devil in a day. And usually when a song comes out mostly all in a day, they're usually really good.
Yeah.
You know, they're just...
So they include the vocals?
It didn't include the vocals. So just the instrumental that you hear, that whole arrangement and everything, it was just there in a day. We kind of were scared of it because we're like, dude, this is kind of poppy or something, you know? And we were like, I'm not sure about this, you know? Like, ooh, what have we done here, you know? Like, but it's really good. You know? There's something to it, you know? So we just put it to the side.
Yeah.
And we just wrote the rest of the record.
Okay.
And we were like, that song is probably not going to make the record because it's just too, like, something, you know? Like, it's something else. And then we were coming towards the end of the record, and we were like going for a drive at night, listening to all the songs together. And we were like, actually, just play Speak of the Devil again. And we played it, and we were like, you know what? This doesn't sound outside of everything else within the rest of the songs, you know? It was just a new step for us.
And so how did the vocals come together?
So that was pretty funny because we were like, you know, I think for this to be a single, it needs like kind of like a bit of a hook on there for sure. And we're like, okay, what are we going to do? And our manager / best friend for life, Tim Levinson, aka Earthboy, came to us with a strange suggestion that was, how about we get Chaos Emerald, who is basically my partner,
right,
Claire Nakazawa.
Now in Haiku Hands.
Now in Haiku Hands, who are killing shit. But basically, and she, you know, at the time wasn't a vocalist. You know?
Okay.
She's
an artist, isn't she?
She's an artist. She's a visual artist. But we had written a rap song for Tim's birthday, the earlier in that year or something. And she like literally slayed her rap. And,
right.
And like, then I was like, my rap was kind of lame next to hers. You know, it was just a silly song for his birthday. Basically, we gave it to him.
Yeah.
But Tim heard this kind of thing in Claire, was like, dude, Claire's rap's really good. And I was like, yeah, what? Like, yeah, it is, isn't it? And he's like, yeah. Anyway, that must have stuck in his mind. And he came back to us, was like, what about you get Claire for the chorus? And it won't be like a polished professional singer thing. It'll be more kind of punky, you know, and energy and stuff. And we're like, oh yeah, let's give that a try. And we tried it with her once. We did a demo and it didn't really work. And we're like, that wasn't the right thing. But it was like, she came into the studio, it was like the middle of the day. It just wasn't any, it was like kind of, she was really nervous and we were kind of nervous and it was like, you know, and it just wasn't the right vibe. And then we're like,
it's not odd, certainly an odd dimension to bring into your relationship.
It was also that, you know, there was like kind of, hey, babes, you want to come into the studio, put this demo down? She was like, okay, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we could hear that it was like potentially maybe something there. So we retried it and we're like, no, let's get the vibe right. And we went in at night and we just kind of like psyched up for it.
Because, yeah, it's a party vibe.
Yeah, it was a massive party vibe. And we were like, okay, you know, let's bring the energy. And she was literally kind of like running on the spot, delivering these vocals and like, and we got it. And it was like, whoa, this is so weird. You know what you wanna dance, 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 dance. We were like, wow, this is like the first kind of crossover sort of poppier song that we've got. And we send it into Triple J and they loved it, and it was like, holy shit. And that was like the beginning of a new era for us.
Definitely. The last thing on that song, like the percussion is sick. I mean, we're talking about timbales earlier. Like, so you busted them out.
Yeah, totally. It was like, you know, that's just in my repertoire. You know, I have timbales and I was like, you know what this track needs?
Yeah.
It needs some timbales.
So like the Hot Past, the album in, like came out as well. I find like it's interesting now knowing that you did Speak of the Devil at the end, because like the opening track some of your albums are really interesting. The opening track of like Hot Past is so heavy,
yeah,
like Engage, and it's very DJ Shadow.
Totally.
Was it a pushback against like the two the other things that you had? You're like making a statement, we're not selling out.
No, it was literally just we wrote, you know, we were just writing a lot of tracks for an album. And with Hyper Paradise, you know, we were like, let's not put any boundaries on ourselves for this. Let's just write whatever we want. You know, it could be an R&B song, it could be a, you know, a old DJ Shadow song.
Right.
But so we were generally like, we weren't actually looking to write older style songs. We were just like pushing forward. We were
it
like,
seems like you chose to not have MCs.
Yeah, yeah. It was like, we want to make a really instrumental heavy record.
I think that's some people never escape from the need to keep it real. You guys did.
Well, we didn't want to be a lot of the early albums. We were like put into the Oz hip hop scene. And we never felt like completely Oz hip hop. We had like one foot in Oz hip hop and one foot in like electronic beats world, you know?
Yeah.
And with Hyper Paradise, we really wanted to go into the electronic world.
Okay.
And so we took our foot out of the hip hop scene and we didn't go with any rappers, you know?
Yeah.
But Engage came about, it was just a song that happened, you know? We were just like, whoa, this doesn't really sound like the rest of the record, but it's heavy. And yes, it was like drum focused and just like, rah,
we are here, motherfuckers.
Yeah, but we finished it, we were like, I think this is the opening song. It just had the opening song vibe.
The Flume remix of Hyper Paradise, which I'm sure you've talked about a bunch.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, how do you feel about it now as a piece of music?
Oh man, it's amazing. I think it's, you know, it's a great song. It's just such, it's just a vibe. He kind of flipped it completely, but it was just amazing to get that back when, like, you sent it back in the email. We were like,
did you know it was special when you got it back?
Yeah, I mean, we were like, man, this is really good. But I don't think anyone knew it was going to do what it did, you know? Like, it was like, he was like, man, I think this is really dope. And we were like, dude, it's fucking dope, you know? And we're like, cool, like, we'll put it out and then, you know, see what happens. And then Triple J started playing it and then it just snowballed.
Did you guys hang out at all, or was he just someone that you sent a song to remix to and stuff?
We didn't really hang.
He's so much younger than you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we basically heard his shit getting played on FBI, you know, like his first early like EP and stuff. And we were like, man, this kid can write some nice beats. Like, and when we were thinking about remixes, we're like, let's send one to, let's hit Flume up, you know?
Yeah.
And this is before he was massive, you know.
Yeah.
He supported us for the Speak of the Devil single launch in Sydney and played to like 40 people as people were coming in, you know.
Just seeing the success that song had, he made, do you think it affected your songwriting at all?
I don't know. I mean, I guess it affected the scene in a way.
Yeah.
It sort of made what we were doing, it took it to the world, you know.
Yes.
Because we were kind of on that tip, you know, with Hyper Paradise. I feel like that was the sort of beginning of that sound for us and also the world, you know, like.
Okay, of course, yes. The thing that strikes me is the minimalism. I find that really interesting and that kind of, it comes into everybody's music from that point on.
Yeah, yeah. Hudson Mohawk was a massive influence for us as well.
Glasgow boy.
His shit is so dope and we were just loving that. And then, you know, he did that like Satin Panthers and then Tonight came out as well and that was huge for everyone, you know, the whole trap thing.
Well, let's start talking like about that, because then Dark Knight Sweet Light 2015, there's trap influences in there. Like, just break it down for people who don't know. What makes those songs trap influenced? What does that mean?
I guess it's the tempo, the kind of like like 70 BPM or 140, depends how you want to look at it. And, you know, trap's been around for a long time from the south, you know, southern hip hop. It was always kind of there, 808s, you know.
Do you know off the top of your head any early southern hip hop?
I just knew like Outkast and stuff like that. Right. And that kind of like, they always had like 808 influence and stuff, and like Goody Mob and all that sort of stuff. It was just kind of like this.
Is it fair to say the drum sound is a big distinctive thing?
Oh, totally.
It's like, it's the sound, and that's the on Dark Knight Speedlight, you hear that the drums have that. Yeah. Is that the 808?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and the 808 is obviously the kick, like the bass drum that's just kind of like the bass note as well.
And so you're really limiting your palate to those drum sounds.
Yeah, I mean, I think with Dark Knight Sweet Light, we definitely, you know, it was a lot of 808s and that sound, but also it's, you know, everything we do always has this Hermitude flavor, which is kind of... this is a musical, I know musical sounds ridiculous because we're making music, but it's just kind of, it's not so limited, no. You know what I mean?
Well, definitely, I think like Through the Roof is a great yeah. example of a song that like sounds, it undeniably has the roots in a Hermitude.
Yeah, exactly. There's always that element, we're like super colorful, and there's probably a lot, we're not super minimalist,
yeah,
which is funny because we actually tried to be minimal on Dark Knight Sweet Light, and it's really hard.
Well, that's something, I mean, that obviously The Buzz is an interesting track to talk to about,
yeah,
that,
yeah,
is the song that kind of exploded you everywhere, really.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that was The Buzz is minimal.
Do you remember anything about like the process of making that? Like,
yeah, we had the intro and the kind of build up to the drop, and we wrote that in a sitting, and then we had this drop that was really.
Hey, what does a sitting look like for you guys? So it's like you and Dubs, you're in the studio. Do you jam stuff out, like kind of, or do you sit there on a computer and kind of move things around?
It varies. We basically have a studio, and we've got all our synths and everything set up in there, and everything's kind of ready to go. And we basically just go in and we sit down and we're like, okay, what do we want to do? And we might start with some chords, or we might start with some drums, or we just whatever we're feeling, basically. And I think particularly with The Buzz, we started with the chords, the bum 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 bum, and like we actually played them in on the Juno 6, Roland Juno 6, and sampled them and then like chopped them and played them in like a sample to give it that kind of more choppy feel,
right?
And that's kind of the beginning of that song, you know. And we sort of did the intro and that versey build up part to the drop, and then we had this really lame drop that we wrote that day that just didn't work, and I was like, okay, well, it's just, that was an idea for a song, but we'll move on. We kept, you know, we're writing the records, or we're just writing a lot of ideas.
Mm.
And then we went and played this festival, Northwest Fest, over in the top end of the Western Australia. And it was like miles away, a really small festival.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really funny.
Like Broome, kind of?
Yeah. Or even, yeah, right, just inside.
I'd love to go there.
Somewhere like near Broome.
Middle of nowhere.
That middle of nowhere.
Far away. Like, Australia's a long way from anywhere, and this is as far as you can get in Australia.
It took literally almost 2 days to get there. Like, literally. It was like a 4-day round trip. And there was this one performance in the middle of it, you know.
Awesome.
It was crazy. But I remember, like, we went to this thing, and I was chilling in the hotel before the gig, and I put on the headphones, and I was listening to all our demos, and The Buzz came up, and it didn't have vocals in it. Actually, where Matea's vocals are, the, you know, is it just me? Mm-hmm. We had like this really cheesy vocal sample from an a cappella that we like put auto-tune on, and it just gave it some sort of idea. It was like a place mark for this, there's going to be some vocals here. Anyway, I was listening to it, and it was the intro into the build-up and the, you know, the lame drop, and I was like, fuck, man, this is actually something we just need to nail. We need to go home and we need to nail the drop.
Okay.
If we can nail the drop, I think this is going to be something. And I took the Dubs and I was like, dude, listen to this and just imagine like the sickest drop you ever heard. And you like listen to it, and he's like, oh yeah. And he's like, yeah. Because we kind of put it to the side, and it was like, maybe not going to do anything.
How long does it take to make a sick drop?
Well, then it was funny. Like, we literally came back, you know, after this 4-day round trip. The next week we got in the studio and we're like, our goal is to make the sickest drop for this song. And we basically...
Because it's really intricate, like listening to it, like the detail and the design of all the sounds and stuff, like it's pretty, there's a lot of work in there.
Yeah, it was literally about finding that the melody, the sort of melody sound in the drop, the dun 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 dun, dun. It was like finding the right sound for that. Like it was like a real, I don't know, it was like a real production-y kind of way of going about it. But we also had to come up with the riff, you know, and I basically, yeah, was just mucking around with the melody and I whacked like this effect, like this plugin on it that just kind of made it wide and put some delay on it or something, and it just kind of like opened it all up. And we were like, dun, 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 dun. And I was like, oh. And Dubs was sitting behind me on the couch and like I could feel him stand up behind me, you know, just like just stood up and like I'm like, dun, 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 dun. And he's like, yeah. Dun, 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 dun. He's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And like it was like one of those moments that you live for in the studio where it was just like this spark, you know, just like bam. And we're like, whoa, shit. And he came up next to me and he's like, you know, I was like, you know, like this, like da na na na. And he's like, yeah, yeah, keep going, pedal on that. And then maybe we can go like da na na da na na or whatever, you know. Yeah. And then we just like jammed on the riff basically. And it was like, dude, I think we got this. You know? And it was like,
You made the sick drop that you're
yeah,
after.
We made the sick drop. Do you feel the buzz or is it just me? Trust me, something in the air, just above me. Something like a dream state, I can't even see straight. Do you feel the buzz, babe? Do you feel the buzz?
Did you, I mean, did you know it was good? Did you know it was great?
I just knew that this song was fucking cool. Yeah, like cool. It was like cooler than all the other songs.
Sure.
It wasn't like the most obvious single though, you know?
Yeah.
And we had, we put out Through the Roof as the first single and then everyone else was like, can we put out Searchlight as the second single? But me and Dubs were actually like, nah, we need to put out the buzz. This is a way cooler look than going with Searchlight. Even though Searchlight is a great song, the buzz just felt, there was something about it that we could feel in our guts and we were like, we need to go with this song. So we sort of like overruled the label side of things. Okay. We were like, we need to do this as a second single. And it worked, which thank God.
Man. Well, it's so interesting because at that point, things scaled up amazing. Like you guys have been doing gigs for so long. And then like in 2013, when you like had Paris playing at Oxford Arts Factory, which is a great venue, but it might be like 400 or 500 in the center of Sydney and stuff.
Yeah.
Then in 2015, you do the Enmore Theatre, which is like a legendary Sydney venue, 2,000 people.
Yeah.
And then you do the Horden Pavilion, which is the venue that we all dream of doing, that we saw DJ Shadow play at in like 2003.
Yes.
And you sold it out, man. Like,
well, I tell you what, when the booking agents came to us saying, we want to do the Horden Pavilion with you guys, I literally had to lie down on a couch and like collect myself because I was so nervous. Like I was like, I don't know, guys. I don't know if this is a good idea, guys. I think this is maybe we're biting off a bit too much that we can chew, man.
Oh, God.
Like
that's my entire life, man.
Yeah, that's like anxiety was just like rushing through my veins. You know, I was like freaking out, and then I was like,
because you thought it was too big.
Yeah. I mean, it's the Horden, you know? It's like, like we just did the Enmore. I was like, that is like ticking off a life goal.
Like you were in a decade as well.
Yeah.
You're working to get
to it. And I was like, yes, we just did the Enmore. We sold it out. That was amazing, you know? And then they're like, okay, guys, at the end of the year, we want to do the Horden. I'm like, what? We just did the Enmore. Are you kidding? Why would we do that to ourselves? You know, like, what if only half the people turn up and like, and so we said yes, and then I was nervous for the months leading up to it. But then the tickets started selling, you know, and we sold it out like a month before the show. And I was like, whoa, this is crazy. It was at hometown, and it was 5,500 people, you know. And it was like one of the best things in my life, you know. It was incredible, and it was, and you know,
did everything go all right?
And it was a really fucking good gig. That was the other thing, you know, because I'm like, this is going to be one of those ones where it's the biggest gig of our life and it's going to be fucking terrible.
Yeah.
You know, but it was one of those ones where we went up and it was just the energy coming from the crowd, just like I was just floating the whole gig. Sick. It was amazing.
So in 2016, you went and did like EDC, which is the giant American festival in Vegas. I found there's actually, there's a live set is on Mixcloud. You know, that's cool. You can listen to the recording. It's great.
Oh, God.
But like, what's that like? Taking it to America and doing those kind of shows?
That was, yeah. I mean, and that over the last couple of years, basically when we dropped Dark Knight Sweet Light has been the next big step in Hermitude's life is being able to go and slay festivals over in America and have fans and big crowds and sell out our own shows in Atlanta and LA and Chicago and like all these, you know, like we sold out a show in Atlanta and we'd never played there before and it was like 700 people turned up. You know, you just got to pinch yourself at that moment where it's like, this is a really amazing, you know, not everyone gets to do this in their careers as a musician. And yeah, so it's just been a really awesome experience to kind of be able to share your music with, you know, the world. And
you went all through this like with Dubs, mm-hmm. with Luke, and you guys, I'm really intrigued by those relationships because it's like, it's more intense than marriage and you guys have been through so much together. You must have seen each other like change and grow and stuff so much.
Yeah.
Are you happy that you guys have kept it together?
Oh, hell yeah. Definitely. We're brothers, basically, is how it is. You know, we're joined at the hip because of the music we make together, you know?
Yeah.
And it's cool because we have been able to keep it together and we don't hate each other, you know? And it's amazing. We still hang out, you know, outside of music,
right
you
on.
Know? Like, I guess we found each other. We found that we were able to work together really easily when we were kids, you know, when we were teenagers or something. And there was a natural complement of each other's style and thinking. And, you know, I brought rhythm, he brought melody, that kind of thing. And that's just stuck throughout, you know. And I think both our temperaments work really well. Yeah. Like, we're chilled dudes, you know. We're not like... we don't ever kind of like, oh, fuck you, man, fuck you, you know, and like storm out of the studio or anything like that. That doesn't happen. Like, we know each other so well that we do understand that, you know, maybe when we need some space. Yeah. We're just like, cool, you know, let's just not go in today, whatever.
Yeah.
It's just a partnership that is great, you know.
Hey, what's your top five songs of all time? You have to answer. There's no looking at lists and stuff. I'm going to give you my top five to give you a bit of time to think about it.
Okay, cool.
And my top five changes every time just to show you how meaningless it is.
Okay, cool.
Number five is Tool 46 and 2. Number four is Faithless Insomnia. Number three is Hypnotized by Notorious B.I.G. Number two is Organ Donor, DJ Shadow. And number one is Destiny by 07.
Midnight in Perfect World, DJ Shadow.
Just a sentence on why you love it.
The piano. I mean, the piano and the drums, you know, like, it's just spine tingling.
In a way, that it really kind of changed your life.
Yeah, it did. It did. Ballad of Dorothy Parker by Prince, Sign of the Times. Dorothy was a waitress on
a promenade. Are we going descending order here or ascending?
Ascending, I think.
Okay, number one, DJ Shadow. Number two, Prince. Okay.
I guess it's maybe going... I don't know. These are just five songs that I
five
love
songs
in my life.
You love. Okay.
And then...
I like to put needless pressure on things.
Yeah. Chameleon, Herbie Hancock.
Great.
As I explained before.
And so these are... This is very important, mate.
Yeah.
We will hold you to these.
I'm going to go with um, Thriller. Trying to think of some more recent stuff that I'm loving.
Yeah, man, I was going to ask you what you listen to at the moment.
I love the album Let England Shake by, God, I can't even remember her name. What the hell?
One more Australian song. It's got to be Australian.
Australian?
Yeah, it's got to be Australian. Man. Yeah.
Oh, you're killing me. No, I was going to go like, no, I can't okay. Do it.
All right, man. Let England shake. Wait to die. Thank you, El Gusto.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
No worries.